This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield, and we're going to start this week's program with a cliche.
I first got into running because I needed to find a way out of my reality. I needed some escape.
Or at least something that sounds at first like a cliche. But listen to a little more about what 19-year-old Jose Reza has to say about running, and you'll begin to understand how running has served him on a brave journey.
I needed to have that moment that I never had. I needed to enjoy my childhood, which I never did.
Reza was born in Guerrero, one of Mexico's southern provinces. His mother was concerned about his welfare every day.
There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of cartels. The parents afraid of letting the kids out because they don't know if they're still going to come back due to the fact that they just pick you up from the street. People have been decapitated, sometimes in front of everyone, bodies hanging on the streets.
When he was 9, Jose Reza's father began telling him that he should drop out of school. There was no point in trying to get an education or dreaming about a place where that might be possible. He should go to work. Reza had another idea. He shared it with his mother, though he knew it was a long shot.
In Mexico, the only people that go to college is the people that have money, the people that are on the top and not in the bottom. I always told her my dream was to one day go to college, a dream which I never thought would come true.
Reza's mom liked the dream, but she had more pressing concerns. She feared for Jose's safety.
We tried so many times getting a visa or a permit to come to the U.S., but the process was so long and we were at the bottom. Of course, we didn't have the money, so we weren't put on top. The violence in my town, it was just getting worse. Like, there was a kid missing every single day, someone missing. And my mom thought that at any point I could be the next person missing. So she's like, I'm sorry, but we just tried so many times doing it the right way, and it's not working, and I can't have you here no more. She's like, I'd rather take you the illegal way than regret it later on.
The illegal way is dangerous for lots of reasons. Jose was 15 when his mother made that desperate choice.
I remember being in the back of trucks, not being able to breathe. It's just so hard, the darkness, the soreness after I got up from one truck to jump into another one. I thought I was not going to make it. Walking in the desert, being afraid of the snakes and all the heat. When we crossed the border, we had to run. I don't remember why we had to run, but we had to run.
But we aren't yet to the point of the story where running becomes a source of joy and hope for Jose Reza.
When I crossed the border, I thought it was over, but it wasn't.
Jose and his mother hid in a so-called cover-up house in South Texas for weeks.
You couldn't talk loud. You couldn't see anything but walls. At one point, we thought we were kidnapped, only being fed once a day. As a kid, I needed to eat. I was hungry. I would complain. I'm like, what's going on, Mom? Why aren't we in the promised land that you told me?
Eventually, Reza and his mother made it to Florida, where they had family. Sports were not in the picture right away. In fact, school didn't turn out to be in the picture right away.
I had to go to work in the fields. I remember picking oranges, and I told myself, I can't do this forever. And my mom told me, this is not what I brought you here for. And now, although it's going to be tougher for me, I want you to go to school. I had a mix of emotions, because I wanted to go to school. That was my main goal. But she was going to have to be the one paying all the bills.
The drive to get an education won out, but at first, there were challenges.
So the first day was miserable. I can't tell you what happened because I didn't understand what was going on in class. It frustrated me. Frustrated me because I wanted to make the best out of it. I wasn't just going to sit there and not understand what the teachers were saying to me. What was the point of it?
Another anxious student might have sought help from a parent, but Jose's father was still in Mexico, and besides, he was the guy who'd told Jose to quit school when he was 9, and Jose's mother couldn't offer much guidance.
I remember when I would get close to her dorm, I would hear her cry. I would hear her, like, come home from the fields, really exhausted. But she never wanted to show it to me because she wanted me to pay attention to school. She didn't know what school was like. And I remember at one point telling me, son, I apologize because I can't help you with school. If you need help, you don't have no one to help you. It's just me and you, and I can't help you with it. And I just remember telling her, it's okay, Mom. You're helping me by letting me go to school. You're helping me by sacrificing yourself, by coming home from work exhausted, by preventing those tears from coming down your eyes when I'm in front of you. But I know they happen, and I'm sorry, and I promise you one day I'll make it better for the both of us.
Jose got some help from the nearby migrant center, which provided him with an English sentence dictionary. For a time, he studied it to the exclusion of everything, including invitations from friends to play basketball and football. Sometimes he would fall asleep with the dictionary open in his hands. Before long, his grades soared. He piled up hundreds of hours of service outside the school. He made the National Honor Society and became president of its local chapter. In short, he became an excellent candidate for education beyond high school until the college admissions officers focused on a single detail.
As soon as they found out that I didn't have my documents, I would never hear back from them. So one day, I was so frustrated. I didn't know what to do. So I decided to, I don't know where, go for a run. I remember that day I ran 7 miles. I don't know how I did it, but all I know is that as soon as I started running, everything just blurred out. Not worrying about anything, just tears coming out of my eyes and keep on running.
Jose kept running for the release it brought, and eventually people began to notice. His friends suggested that he try out for the cross-country team.
And I was like, I don't do it for competition. It has a more significant meaning to me. And then the coach told me, that's the kid that I want to be running on my team. Someone that runs with their heart, that runs for something greater than themselves.
So attitude counted, as did perseverance. And then there was talent. Jose Reza was good at what he was doing, which, though it may not seem entirely just or logical, put his candidacy for a college scholarship on a faster track.
One day my coach told me that if you run, most of the schools are really not going to care about your documents. As soon as I heard that, I just put all my effort into it. I started practicing more, doing the extra things that no one else did at practice, waking up in the morning at 5 to go run, running at night, because I started running my senior year, and I only had 1 year if I really wanted to make it to college.
The extra effort impressed track coach Vince DeGrotto at Allen Community College in Kansas. Jose's 4.6 grade point average probably didn't hurt. In any case, just before he finished high school, Jose learned that he'd be able to take advantage of the opportunity he and his mother had been dreaming about when they began heading north from Guerrero.
She didn't know until like that day of my graduation that I told her, hey mom, it's not over. I'm going to college. It's possible now. It's not just a dream. She couldn't believe it. She's like, don't play with me. That's not something to play around with. I'm like, hopefully she doesn't get a heart attack, because she was just like, she was screaming, she was dancing, she was excited.
Jose Reza is raising the money he needs to live in Kansas as a college student via a GoFundMe page. He's found the transition comfortable, he's made friends easily, especially among the other men and women on the track team. Reza would love to have his mother see him in his role as a college athlete, but it's not likely.
That would be a dream come true, but unfortunately, she can't afford missing work. She wasn't able to watch me when I was at home, like the races that was like 10 minutes away from the house because she was at work. It'll mean the world to me, but I just gotta accept the fact that she can't miss work.
On the rare occasions when Reza looks back, he's never second-guessed the decision his mother made to leave Mexico.
Most of my friends are not there no more. I don't know where they ended up. I don't know what happened to my family members back at home. They just completely disappeared. And I could have been one of those if it wasn't because of my mom.
Thanks to his mother and his own grit, Jose Reza has a new dream. He hopes to become a biology teacher. But in the current of success that carried Jose Reza to Texas and then to Florida and then to Kansas, there's the potential for a nasty undertow. Remember, he and his mother crossed the border without papers. Their desperation to escape the threats and violence of home has not been certified by the authorities in the U.S., so Jose Reza's decision to go public with his story is risky.
It is something that I worry about, but it's not going to stop me. It's not going to stop me because now it's about telling others that they can do it. And if that's my price, I'm more than willing to pay for it. But I'm putting myself in the public because I want to serve as an example. I want to tell them, look at me. I'm all of the things I had to go through, and I'm still here fighting to be someone You have the opportunity. Why not take it?
You have the opportunity. Why not take it? Kind of has the ring of the American dream, doesn't it? I can offer you my forgiveness. That's a sentence at the end of the exceptional letter written by six women who began playing soccer at Harvard in 2012. It's a simple sentiment, but an important one, given the witless cruelty to which it serves as response. In 2012, the members of the Harvard men's soccer team took part in what was apparently a tradition of rating the female soccer players according to appearance. The men assigned the women numbers and speculated on the sexual positions for which each might be best suited. That story appeared in the Crimson, Harvard student newspaper, this week. The women also wrote, "We do not pity ourselves, and we know that the only way we can truly move past this culture is for the very men who perpetrate it to stop it in their tracks." The spirit of resistance to oppression is in this letter, but what makes it even more significant is the determination of the women to move beyond outrage. They have too much confidence in themselves and each other as women and as athletes to feel diminished by insults. As they write, "We know what it's like to get knocked down, to lose a few battles, to sweat, to cry, and even still we keep fighting for ourselves, yes, but above all, for our teammates. This document might have stung any other group of women you chose to target, but not us." I see in that letter a welcome quality of hope. That's because the women who wrote it chose to end it with a statement at once gracious and powerful. "I can offer you my forgiveness," they wrote, "which is and forever will be the only part of me you can ever claim as yours." The story and the letter provoked Harvard to investigate the 2012 incident and discover that the male soccer players rated the members of the female team in 2013, too, and in 2014, 15, and 16. Harvard President Drew Faust, citing, among other things, the male players' failure to be forthcoming when initially questioned, canceled the men's season, thus creating, as the cliche has it, a teachable moment. We have lots more coming up on Only a Game, but first I'd like to thank Chris for the following review of our podcast. "I enjoy this show in many ways more than I enjoy sports themselves. The show is about being human and telling the story of our species in this place and in time." Consider joining Chris with a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. If you were of a mind to stay up late on Wednesday night and into Thursday morning Eastern time, you might have heard this.
And the Cubs have finally won it all! 8-7-10!
Fun fact, the last time the Chicago Cubs won the World Series, the Dow Jones closed at 65. And that's where we're going to begin this week's three stories you should know, with the Cubs, not with the Dow Jones numbers. Joining me this time around are Will Leach of Sports on Earth via Skype and Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal. Welcome back to both of you.
Great to be here.
Of course. Thank you.
Will, you were at the World Series, so of course you'll go first.
Yes, well, I was at the World Series, but, you know, somewhat under protest, being a Cardinals fan. I'm a St. Louis Cardinals fan. I grew up in Central Illinois, which is right where that border of Cardinals fans and Cubs fans are. My poor father has been afraid to wear his Cardinals hat walking outside. It's a tough time for Cardinals fans. And so I'm doing this delineation. I am happy for longtime Cubs fans, for fans who have waited a long time. I found it just as moving as everybody else did when people were writing the names of people that did not get to see the Cubs win the World Series on the wall on Waveland Avenue. I think it was very touching, and I'm happy for those people. Now, for the people that think David Ross has played for the Cubs for 20 years, or the people that are in your Facebook feed that are suddenly like, "I spent a month in Chicago one time, and I love the Cubbies. I'm so happy for you guys." The Cubs are your pet rock. OK, and I'm not happy for you at all. I'm happy for longtime Cubs fans, and there are many of them, and I'm glad they've had that experience. But let's just not forget, in 2004, everyone was happy for the Red Sox, and it did not take long for that to turn. That turn is coming.
Rachel, I'm not sure there's anything left to say, but please chime in if you're so inclined.
Well, I will say that one thing that struck me, as it did probably a lot of people watching the series, is just how much has changed since not only the last time the Cubs won the series, but in the last few decades of baseball. I was actually at Game 7 in 1991 when my hometown Minnesota Twins beat the Braves, mm-hmm. and I don't even have a photo of myself there because, of course, we didn't run around with cameras in our pockets then. Fast forward to Game 7 this year, I'm watching on Twitter. There's this, you know, huge conversation going on nationally and internationally. So it's just astounding how much has changed, not only, you know, since the early 1900s, but also just in the past few decades.
Will, I can't help myself. I got to pick up on something you said. Am I supposed to feel sorry for Cardinals fans?
Oh, no.
They've won World Series more times than I can. Only the Yankees have won more World Series, I think, than the Cardinals. My goodness. Let's give somebody else a chance from time to time. And the Cubs were, I think it's fair to say, they were due.
No Cardinals fan would ever ask for sympathy in this regard. And certainly the Cubs were due. One would say overdue. One would say still 8 championships behind the Cardinals. That would be another thing someone would say. I actually feel quite bad for White Sox fans. Remember, they broke a streak 10 years ago that was almost as long as this one. And everyone yawned. Everyone was like, oh, right. That's the other team in Chicago. If there's any teams fans to feel sympathy for, I think it's probably the White Sox.
Rachel, you're up next, and I understand that you've got college football on your mind.
Indeed. Well, the Big Ten Conference this week announced it's ending a longstanding taboo and entering into new territory, and that is playing conference football games on Friday nights. And although some other conferences have sort of tiptoed into this territory, it's kind of a big deal the Big Ten has taken this step. High school football fans are very upset about this. They say it's trampling on their traditional Friday night lights territories. I also wonder whether there's a risk of college football straying into NFL territory and so saturating every day and every night with its content that people just kind of get tired of it.
I certainly think that's a strong point. The whole idea of the NFL is supposed to be that there's an event. And of course, college football is based in that as well. I find it telling, as a graduate of a Big Ten school, the University of Illinois, that the big schools of the Big Ten, like Michigan and Ohio State, they just said, nope, we're not doing this. And the Big Ten said, okay, don't worry, we're not going to make you do it. It's more for Illinois and for Purdue and for Northwestern and like the smaller schools that could use that kind of exposure. The Big Ten is very progressive in one way. It makes money. It always sees what's coming next. The rest of college football has been following the Big Ten really for about 20 years now in a revenue aspect. So it's not really a surprise that they would take the small, lousy football teams like mine and say, hey, go ahead and play on Friday night.
Rachel, I'm going to use my time just to ask you a question. Is Will right? Is this simply a business story or is it in any way a sports story?
It's absolutely a business story. This is all about TV dollars, which are really tipping the scales of college coffers now. It used to be that tickets and donations were the overwhelming source of income, and that's absolutely not true anymore. It's these multi-year TV contracts that are driving the bus.
All right. My topic has to do with the other professional football league. That would be the NFL. On Monday, the Washington Post published a story indicating that violent and dangerous behavior at and around NFL games has been increasing for about 5 years now. Incidents are worse and more numerous when division rivals play each other, and there's more violence when the home team loses. And then, of course, when people are allowed to show up earlier and earlier to tailgate, there's more violence because they're drunk by the time the game starts. So here's my question for the two of you. Is this problem a uniquely NFL problem? And if so, is there something NFL teams can or should be doing about it? Rachel, why don't you go first?
Let me start by saying that I'm not a teetotaler. I'm not anti-alcohol. However, I do think this problem is largely driven by alcohol. If you look at the research, binge drinking is up across the board, not just at colleges, across the country in the last 10 years or so. And I do think that the fact that NFL prices are so high makes people sort of go crazy. They want to sort of max out this experience, and they're just sort of going hog wild. Some of this behavior just simply would not happen if people weren't drunk.
That's an aspect of it, definitely. But, you know, it's also worth knowing that there doesn't seem to be a major increase in violence at college football games. And I live in Athens, Georgia. I think people are tailgating now for a game that starts in 8 days. I take my sons to college football games all the time, and it's never an issue. And I am terrified to take them to an NFL game because there is just a different environment there. And on Sunday, I mean, have you seen the parking lot at a Bills game? They're doing wrestling moves through tables. There is a sense, certainly fueled by alcohol, that this is a time to blow off the steam from a frustrating week. It is a release of tension rather than a collective embrace. And I think it's perhaps not surprising that we see that.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been Sports on Earth's Will Leach and The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next story isn't just a story about sports. It's a story about parenting. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
When Walker Aran's parents first realized there was something different about their son, he was just 3 months old, and they didn't think there was any reason to worry.
He was on the living room floor, and Dad was over him, and I could hear Steve going, "Hi, buddy, hi, hi, buddy." And all of a sudden, I heard this little three-month-old baby, clear as a bell, echo his dad, looking straight at him, and this little baby went, "Hi." And I poked my head out of the room that I was in, and I said to Steve, "I did not just hear that." And Steve said, "You did." I said, "I don't know whether to be happy or go, oh my gosh, who does that?"
I was glad she was there to hear it, so I had someone to back me up on it.
But soon, Anna and Steve Aran noticed other unusual things about Walker. Everyday noises set him off. The sound of the microwave door opening or Velcro ripping caused him to throw a fit. Sometimes he wouldn't go to sleep or eat. Anna got a psychologist to check on Walker. Then came a diagnosis: pervasive development disorder, a form of autism.
The person that primarily told us was very matter-of-fact about it and left us with, you know, there's probably not much you can do about this, and so you're just going to kind of have to live with this. And Steve and I aren't really, well, you're just going to have to live with this kind of people.
They responded by setting Walker up with speech, vision, and occupational therapists. And then they stumbled on something that would become another kind of therapy. They took 2-year-old Walker to the nearby ice hockey rink at Davenport University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Walker Aran, now 20, still remembers that moment.
When I first got on the ice, it started off with my dad and my mom trying to hold my hand. And after about 5 minutes, I turned around and I looked at them and I said, I'm okay, essentially. I was like, I got this from here. So it just took off from there.
It didn't take long for Walker to pick up a hockey stick. He found that when he stepped on the ice, his worries disappeared.
It feels freeing, really. I think hockey is a very freeing game, both freeing of, you know, your body and your mind. You know, when you're on the ice, you almost feel like you can fly.
When he wasn't on the ice, Walker watched videos of NHL players and mimicked their moves in his living room. Steve coached all of his son's hockey teams until Walker reached high school. And as Steve recalls, at first, Walker might have loved hockey a little too much.
He's a very competitive guy, very competitive kid, and we had some issues early on with that. Whenever his team lost, he would, his first year, he would just have a meltdown, and he would yell at me and blame it on me, and he would get so worked up he couldn't go on the ice to finish a game.
There were a couple of games when you carried him off by his jersey, kicking and screaming, arms flailing through the air. No, I wanted to win. No, you can't take me off the ice. Okay, yes, we can, son. Here we go.
But the sport's positives quickly outweighed the negatives. Because after Steve and Anna were told that their son wouldn't get past a fourth grade level in math or reading, hockey became therapy. In fact, it replaced more traditional therapies.
We would tie words with plates onto the net, and he would shoot at the letters, and that's how he learned how to spell words. You might not be able to do that with every child, but for him, it worked, and he was motivated to do it. So there he'd be shooting pucks, you know, C-A-T, cat, P-A-N, pan, and he eventually learned to read through some of that and sound things out, and it became his sensory therapy with the crashing and burning on the ice. So it was kind of a multi-purpose thing, and you know, the bottom line is he really, really loved it, loved it, loved it.
It must have helped because Walker kept advancing through school. He was never held back a grade. Walker didn't tell any other kids, not at school or on the ice, about his diagnosis. but sometimes he had to leave the regular classroom to meet with specialists, and sometimes other students in school noticed.
You know, when someone would ask me, like when I was in middle school or in elementary school, why it was I took, you know, a test or, you know, went to a different room for a class, I was kind of too embarrassed to really say why it was I left, because I was afraid that I would get made fun of or be judged. So I would just kind of sheepishly look away and not really say anything.
And when Walker moved on to high school, he continued to keep his disorder a secret from other students and his new hockey teammates. Walker's parents worried about how their son would manage in a high school locker room.
He's coming in as a 14, 15-year-old, and there are some of these guys that are 18 years old. They're young men, and they're talking about a whole different set of things.
I was petrified.
They were worried because Walker had trouble registering sarcasm and understanding jokes. But Walker soon had an ally in the locker room and a plan.
Fortunately, he had his younger brother. You know, his younger brother, Brendan, is kind of a social ace. And so they had this little signal worked out in the locker room. You know, Walker would look at Brendan, and Brendan would send Walker the message, dude, that was humor. Right now, on cue, ha-ha, laugh. That was humor. Yeah. So, yeah, right.
That's amazing.
I think so, too.
Walker did well enough in the classroom to earn honors, and he was good enough at hockey to extend his playing career beyond high school. But before he graduated, there was an important school project.
His English teacher at East Kentwood High School asked them to write a paper in which they had to think about one thing they could offer to the universe, to change the universe. And he said, I think I'm ready. I'm ready to let kids my age know that I have autism, but autism doesn't have me. And I was just stupefied. I mean, that was a really profound thought.
Walker wrote the paper on living with autism, and soon he had an opportunity to share his story with an even larger audience. A family friend and local artist was preparing for an upcoming competition in Grand Rapids called Art Prize. She wanted to paint Walker, and next to the painting, she wanted to include an excerpt from his essay. And this wasn't just any art event. Held in downtown Grand Rapids every year, Art Prize attracts hundreds of thousands of attendees. Walker considered the offer for about a week, and then he agreed to have his story included. And then on the day it opened,
he came home from school and he said, Mom, this freakish thing happened today. He said, I'm sort of freaked out about it. He said, all of these kids saw my painting. And he said, my phone is blowing up. He said, I bet I have 150 texts. Is that you, Walker? Is that you, Walker? He said, Mom, I didn't know I had friends. I said, right. I said, how you feel about all this? He said, I've decided it's okay.
After a year playing junior hockey in Wisconsin, Walker enrolled at Davenport University, the same nearby school where he first learned to skate. Once again, he was meeting a new set of teammates who didn't know about his disorder. And now the age gap between Walker and the oldest players was even larger than it had been when he first entered high school.
I was 19, and I was on a team with guys who were 23 and 24 years old. It was intimidating, and I was definitely kind of nervous about maybe how that dynamic would work.
You probably won't be surprised to learn that his parents were nervous, too. But before Walker's first season began, Anna's fears were eased.
I know this is going to sound silly, but it was when he got his first text from Alex Fonseca, an older guy. And Fonzie, they call him lovingly Fonzie, and Fonzie texted him. And I said, oh, who was that? And he said, Fonzie. And I said, the guy on the team, yeah. And I thought, oh, this is cool. He's made a connection. He gets it. He said, Fonzie wants me to come over. And I just went, yes, yes, he does. Yes, you're going. Yes, go, go. You're going to Fonzie's house. Yes, you are. And I didn't even know who Fonzie was.
A little over a year later, Fonzie is now one of Walker's closest friends. Walker is currently a sophomore marketing major. He was recently admitted to the university's honors program. And the Davenport hockey team entered the weekend with an 8-0 record. Walker, a defenseman, has played in every game. Thanks to the benefits of all the childhood therapies, on and off the ice, Walker's college teammates might not have known Walker had autism if he hadn't told them. The only time I could sense anything unusual in my conversation with Walker was when I asked him where he would be without hockey, and he answered literally. So I asked Steve and Anna that same question.
I can't imagine. We'd probably had to find something else. What would it? I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. He played baseball. You know, he was a catcher in baseball. But
there's a lot of parallels I like to look at between athletic teams and the world, in the business world, you know, which I operate in. And whenever I can see an example of, I'll tell them, you know, what you do here in the locker room like this, the business rules just like that. So those parallel lessons pointing out now so that as he moves into an adult workplace setting in a few years, he can draw on those experiences that he had mm-hmm. in athletics and apply it to the workplace. Mm-hmm.
But before Walker has to worry too much about getting a job, he has a more immediate goal, sharing his story. The same guy who used to hide his disorder from other students and teammates recently published an essay about his experience on a Michigan hockey website. These days, Walker Rand has nothing to hide, and he wants to make a difference.
I hope that if there's someone else out there that's like me, that this shows them that, you know, there's hope for everybody. If your gut's telling you to go and achieve something, then go do it. And don't worry about what other people tell you that you can and can't do.
For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Coming up on Only a Game, Aliquippa, Pennsylvania was known for steel and for high school football.
Sometimes the teams would have 10, 11, 12 guys going off to Division I schools. Aliquippa was a factory not just for making steel, but for making Americans.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, former NBA player Stephon Marbury provides an alternative to expensive sneakers marketed to people who can't afford them. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Very early on Thursday morning, and there's only one way to put this, even a few days later, Cubs win! Were you delighted?
I was, actually, and I was extraordinarily delighted by the baseball game. Because every couple of years, baseball reminds you why people took it so seriously for so long.
One story about this remarkable development was headlined, "How did the Cubs curse end with the greatest game ever?" I don't know, a bit of an overstatement, or is this okay?
Well, I mean, I go back once again to what Reggie Jackson once said about the greatest ball player. He said, "I don't need someone to tell me I'm the greatest ball player. I just need somebody to tell me I'm in the conversation." This game is in the conversation. There's no question. If for nothing else, for the 17-minute rain delay, where we all got to, like, tear our hair out.
According to Ticket IQ, four tickets for Game 7 seats near the Cubs dugout sold for nearly $22,000 apiece. But ticket prices for Wednesday night's game were actually down a little bit on average. So I guess good news for Joe and Josephine baseball fan, right?
Yeah, I suppose. I think the prices probably got knocked down a little bit because people got terrified by the early estimates. But I'm telling you what, for $22,000 a seat, you ought to be in the Cubs dugout.
In uniform, absolutely. The Cubs, by the way, have already been installed as a 3-1 favorite to win the World Series next fall. Cleveland is at 12-1, so maybe Terry Francona et al. Can sneak up on everybody next season.
Well, I mean, we'll see next year whether Cleveland can manage to keep its entire team together for a season. I mean, what they did in the face of the injuries they had was just extraordinary.
It was indeed. Kevin Turner, late of the Philadelphia Eagles and the New England Patriots, died back in March, Charlie, from complications associated with ALS. He was the lead plaintiff in a concussion lawsuit against the NFL, and after examining Turner's brain, Dr. Ann McKee announced this week that he had advanced chronic traumatic encephalopathy and that his brain provides the strongest possible case so far for a link between CTE and ALS. Is that designation, strongest possible link, going to change anything?
Well, I don't know, but to me it means that Kevin Turner belongs in the Football Hall of Fame because he will be a monumental figure in whatever changes get rung in this game over the next 10 years.
Eagles wide receiver Josh Huff was recently charged with possessing a handgun without a permit. Regarding same, he said this week, quote, "I'm a professional athlete. What professional athlete don't have a gun?" The team released him on Thursday. I'm not sure if it was to answer that question or not.
I got to give the team credit for guts.
That's right. He has a gun.
Yeah, man's got a gun, and he's proud of it. A lot of them do, and a lot of them claim to need it. I'm not entirely sure that many of them do need it, but it's become a symbol along with whatever else, you know, giant cars and movie stars and stuff like that. Plus, by the way, this is the America that the NRA wants. I'm tired hearing people complain about athletes with guns. According to the NRA, they're the best Americans we have.
18-year NBA veteran Ray Allen announced his retirement this week. He is currently the 22nd leading NBA scorer and is recognized as the greatest three-point shooter of all time. He is 41 years old, so despite the fact that he can still hoist threes, no surprise, I guess, that he retired.
No surprise, but he's going to be able to hoist threes till he's 81. His shooting stroke is the best I've ever seen.
He was not only good at hoisting threes, he was good at getting himself traded or somehow situated on teams that were about to win again.
Yes, he did. The latter part of his career between the Celtics and Miami, he did a great job on that.
Is Mr. NASCAR in the house?
He's right here. What
very
can he do
good,
for
you? Very good.
What can
okay.
he boom, do for you?
Excellent. Jimmy Johnson sits atop the Sprint Cup standing with just three races left. And some are wondering, not necessarily me, but some, whether a win this year would push Johnson past NASCAR legends Richard Petty and Dale Earnhardt. What do you think?
I think charisma-wise, he doesn't have a chance, but certainly, you know, career result-wise, he would. I mean, Jimmy Johnson's he's a good guy and a great driver, but he ain't the king and he ain't the intimidator. He ain't no folk hero.
I knew there was a reason I called on Mr. NASCAR for this one, and I'm happy that I did. The minor league team that used to be called the Jacksonville Suns will henceforth answer to the name Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp. How long before they have Oxymoron Day at the ballpark in Jacksonville?
Well, I think you just gave them an idea for the first big promotion of the season. It's a stupid name, by the way.
Well, that's okay. They'll probably change it next year. It's a minor league baseball team.
Well, that's true. Yeah, maybe they can pay, you know, Tufts $100 and just call themselves the Jumbos.
How permanent can the name be? If it doesn't work, find another one. On Wednesday, the University of Maryland's women's basketball team scored 74 points and allowed their opponent, Bluefield State, 17 points. And that was at halftime that score was rung up. The final score was 146-17. I loved our energy and enthusiasm, said Maryland head coach Brenda Fries. I bet the Bluefield State coach wasn't saying anything even remotely similar to that.
Well, obviously Maryland turned up the defense in the second half.
I'm glad I wasn't there. I think Maryland fans started pulling for Bluefield State by the end of the game.
Yeah, but don't you think Maryland fans started pulling out of the parking lot about 5 minutes left in the first half?
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week as well here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Imagine a city that used to have several reasons to consider itself pretty great. Built for workers and prepared to provide them with all the overtime they could handle and pay them accordingly, it was a city that initially thrived, pretty much as the planners felt that it and its inhabitants would. Home to folks from all over the country and a lot of the rest of the world, it was a city where everybody could cooperate productively in the mills and the factories, if not always in the restaurants and the bars. And it was a city where high school football was king and provided the good players, and there were a lot of them, with the opportunity to build for themselves lives even richer than the ones their parents were living.
There's a real pride of place about Aliquippa and a feeling that they're special. And frankly, as tough as it's gotten, I agree with them. It's a special place, and I'm gratified that they welcomed me there to tell their story.
S.L. Price has spent the last several years visiting Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, the story of which begins in 1905 when the Jones and Laughlin Steel Company began establishing a company town to handle the work that had outgrown their operations 20 miles upriver in Pittsburgh.
Essentially, they bought the remnants of a town on the ruins of an old amusement park, divided into 12 plans. Serbs in one place, Croats in another, Irish here, Poles over there. Plan 6 was for the management types. Plan 11 extension was for the blacks who had come up from the south during the Great Migration. They said they wanted to build a town to make the best life a steel worker could possibly have.
The best life a steel worker could possibly have. Sounds too good to be true, doesn't it? It was. Jones and Laughlin built a company town in which everybody in town was dependent on the company. The work was hard. The injuries were frequent. The workers were paid in company scrip, redeemable only at the company store. And if they left their jobs, those workers were tossed out of their company housing by a company police force, which the company also used to discourage union organizers, sometimes by breaking their heads. For amusement, the residents had high school football of a sort.
It was not a good team. It wasn't known as a good team until
really until the post-war period.
Over the years, the fortunes of the football team rose and fell, and eventually mostly rose. Aliquippa had baseball, too, and basketball, but the residents, no matter their race or background, tended to care most about football.
I think it's because of steel. I think it's because of factories, because both football and those factories depend on, you know, collective striving, on the line, on the melding of various skill sets, on the numbing repetition of the work. And if you don't do your job, someone might get hurt. Football and steel depended on and in some ways, even in a twisted way, celebrate the trade of health for money. It's tragic in its own small, slow-motion way.
And for a while, Aliquippa thrived in the steel mill and on the football field. In the first three games of the 1942 season, Aliquippa High outscored their opponents by a total of 93-6. A little more than a decade later, a fellow entered Aliquippa High who stood just 5'7 and weighed 135 pounds. Determined to build himself into a football player, he worked out relentlessly and fortunately grew a little taller. By the time he was a junior, he was big enough at 6 feet, 160 pounds to be an average player on a good team and provide his family with every reason to attend games.
His father worked on the Allegheny Railroad, which was a railroad that ran within the mill itself. He was a burner. He worked with acetylene torches and was constantly coming home with burns in his clothes and on his hands. And he was a very tough guy, little Mike Ditka, Mike's dad.
Yeah, that Mike Ditka. One of a lot of Aliquippa boys to ride a taste for football into a scholarship to play in college and eventually a career in the NFL. Though, according to Price, that was not young Mike's initial plan.
Ditka famously and hilariously was going to Pitt not to be a football player and certainly not to be a pro football player, but to be a dentist. And everybody in Aliquippa sort of laughs to this day at the idea of Mike and his meat hook hands. And, you know, the joke, of course, is that, you know, he'd knock out your teeth and then fix them for you.
He'd have been the world's most competitive dentist, for sure. Instead, Mike Ditka, 5'7", 135, as a high school freshman, played well enough at Pitt to encourage the Chicago Bears to draft him. Then he won Rookie of the Year honors and set a record for touchdown receptions by a Bears rookie. Lots of people in Aliquippa noticed.
Once Mike sort of set the example in a high-profile way of using football as a way to get an education, you know, it became pretty quickly clear that football was a route out because fathers desperately wanted their kids to not work in the steel mill and get away from the steel mill.
Soon, lots of people in Aliquippa stopped dreaming their sons would become dentists or doctors, lawyers, or businessmen. The NFL became the only goal. Was Aliquippa unique in that respect? No, but for a time, the town was good at lots of things other than providing hard work.
In many ways, I mean, Aliquippa was a factory not just for making steel, but for making Americans, and the school system was very good. Many did go off, especially in the 50s and 60s, and use football to get their degrees. Sometimes the teams would have 10, 11, 12 guys going off to the Division I schools.
So far, so good. Or anyway, better than unemployment and hanging out on the corner. Unfortunately, that would come. While Mike Ditka was coaching the Chicago Bears from 1982 until 1992, the steel industry in the U.S. was dying. Days everybody had legitimately considered long and hard began to look pretty good.
Aliquippa was a place where a working man could raise a family, buy a house, have vacation, maybe have a boat, and have a feeling that they had a foothold in the American dream and that their kids could do better than they could. And once steel went down, very quickly in the 80s, people were thrown out of work by the hundreds and by the thousands. This was a town built for work, and suddenly the work was taken away. In the vacuum, crime and drugs rushed in. And this is not obviously unique to Aliquippa, but it happened there in incredibly sharp and intense ways.
In 1982, Pete Iritano, a classmate of Mike Ditka's, helped set up a food bank for the families of men who had lost their jobs. President Reagan called Iritano to congratulate him on that achievement and to tell him not to worry, the jobs would be back. The president was wrong. As Price learned, crime would increase by 40% the following year, and, quote, police found themselves arresting men who'd never before been in trouble, and wives found themselves being hit for the first time. But football carried on. Maybe it had to. Maybe because there was nothing else to celebrate.
With the demise of the town and the rise in crime, the reputation of Aliquippa has fallen as well. And the football team is the counter to that. It's definitely a haven, and it serves in many ways as the fathers who aren't there in the homes. It's the one thing that says that Aliquippa is strong and prideful and can still produce winners.
Some of the more recognizable names on the roll of winners are Ty Law, who spent 15 seasons in the NFL as a defensive back, Sean Gilbert, who played 11 seasons in the pros, and Darrell Revis, who's still playing today. If some of the players who got football scholarships have failed to take advantage of those opportunities and have come home to nothing much, others have followed Mike Ditka out of town, and the team has continued to win.
They were in the state championship game last year in Western Pennsylvania, so the dynasty continues. This is a Class A school, meaning some 300 students with three dozen or less boys in the senior class, and they were playing at Class 2A for years and years, and last year they decided to move up another class, even though the population has shrunk from 26,000 to 30,000 people down to 9,500 or so.
But the counterweight to the success story is heavier now. Early last month, two Aliquippa High players were arrested for homicide in connection with a drug deal. Both of them were 17. If that story isn't representative, it's familiar.
Was it depressing, basically, to have to research and then tell this story?
Well, I mean, it's depressing in the sense that I feel that all those forces that were cut loose in Aliquippa in the mid-80s and other mill towns and other industries across America are exactly what is animating much of the discontent among voters who are attracted to Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders and others. In many ways, I do think that's a depressing development because those forces are not going to go away with the end of this election. I will say, however, that there are still, even with the negatives in this town, the people are incredible, their spirit is incredible, and there are enough stories of success of where people have gotten out. Kids are still getting out, and football is definitely being used as a way to get out, that every time I would trip over a story of negativity and I would get down about it, then I would trip over another one where somebody has emerged with an incredible spirit.
The story of Aliquippa, through which is woven the story of the history and meaning of a high school football team, is much more thoroughly told in S.L. Price's new book, Playing Through the Whistle, subtitled Steel, Football, and an American Town. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Jeremy Relosa. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from S.L. Price, who recalls what his agent said when he noticed that Playing Through the Whistle ends with the words, "It's only a game."
Andrew called me and said, "Did you notice this?" He's like, "Bill Little will love this." And I said, "Oh, my God."
I do love it. And you'll be hearing from our attorneys. No, that's only me. Kidding. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.